It's nice to see the devas coming here, appearing, bringing tea. quickly, come, we're starting up here. No, I'm just being naughty. So, okay. All right, everyone, so let us get started again here. And we're going to finish off the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the calming of thought. Come to the very end. So we have seen the four first methods of overcoming bad thoughts. Now we're going to come to the last method. And the last method is a bit of an interesting one, as you shall see in a second. So if all the first four methods, if they fail, then we only have the last method left. Yeah. So what is this last method here? And this is how it works. So now suppose that a mendicant is focusing on stopping the formation of the thoughts, right? This is what we just saw, the idea of using, withdrawing the will by being passive and just observing the thoughts. But still, the bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, with hate, I don't know, like hate. Hate is too strong a word. Like ill will, delusion, maybe confusion, keep coming up. With teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, they would squeeze, squash, and torture mind with mind. As they do so, those bad thoughts are given up and come to an end. The mind becomes stilled internally. It settles, unifies, and becomes immersed in samadhi. It's like a strong man who grabs a weaker man by the head or the throat or the shoulder and squeezes, squashes, and tortures them. This is violent stuff here. This is kind of this is the extreme Buddhism. So this is quite remarkable. In the same way, something is missing here. What happened? Something is missing here, I think. No, that's all there. Okay, good. So the idea here, this is obviously willpower, right? Here we have come to willpower. With your teeth clenched, a tongue pressed against the roof of your mouth. You force, you beat down mind with mind. That's, I think, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. You beat down mind with mind. And you force your mind into the right way. And this sounds really kind of really rough, right? There's another place where they're talking about this. And you can use so much willpower that the sweat starts pouring from your body. That's how much willpower you use in one of these places. You may wonder, this sounds a little bit over the top. Is this really a good idea? Are there any psychologists or psychiatrists on this retreat? Do you recommend this sort of practice if you're a psychologist? It sounds dangerous, right? It sounds like you're going to mess yourself up pretty badly if you use this too much. And of course, the idea here is that this is the very last of five, right? If only use this if you're absolutely desperate. If you're just about to kill one of your fellow retreatants, because you're so angry with them, okay, no, don't kill. Oh. That's how you stop yourself when you're completely desperate. There's no other way out. Okay, that's when you use this kind of method. These are good people. You know it deep down, but sometimes you get so frustrated, you just want to kind of finish them off once and for all. That's a bad idea, and we know that. So that's when you use this method. So it is really only in absolutely extreme situations that you use this thing. Because these things are dangerous. We know that this is exactly how people mess themselves up, by suppressing anger, suppressing all kinds of emotions and feelings. And actually, you can become a very imbalanced person if you do this, end up with all sorts of mental problems down the track. So this is not something we should really use. But it's kind of strange when you look at how we often deal with our emotions in daily life, in society. It is often not appropriate to show your emotions, in certain spaces. It's not really right to get angry at certain times. And so very often this is the first method that we use, right? We suppress the anger. Oh no, don't go away, and we cannot suppress it. So actually, we often do the exact opposite of what it says here. We use this as the first method instead of using it as the last one. And so actually, one of the hard things about this way of dealing with the mind is to retrain ourselves so as to use all those wisdom techniques first. First, learning how to see people in a new way, change your perspective, and just allow things to disappear so fast. Look at things, understanding the downside of those thoughts, and because of that, eliminating them. And that is all really wisdom perspective. Moving away from the willpower and you going over to wisdom. This is really what this is about. And this is something all of us need to learn, because it's so easy to use willpower. Willpower is usually the only way that people are really aware of. We don't really have the tools in ordinary society to overcome these negative thoughts. No one teaches this thing when we go to school. We should teach this sutta to the people in school, right? This is how you do it. Sometimes we don't learn what we need to learn in school. We learn all these things that we never get to use. But we don't learn practical life skills like this. Isn't that true? There's some truth to that, right? Actually, these days, there is some meditation and thing is done sometimes, taught in schools, sometimes these days, and I think that's really nice. You get kind of kids to learn to sit peacefully. You don't call it meditation, you call it kind of relaxation time or something. And apparently it's very popular, even with little kids, just relaxing. And so sometimes the Tipitaka should be kind of the curriculum, for when you kind of enter high school, okay, junior year in high school, or kind of whatever it is, you kind of, okay. So these are really important life skills, and I think sometimes we learn kind of things that may not be quite as useful as these simple things, like being kind and all of these kind of things. So this is interesting. So only use these in very desperate circumstances. And one of the kind of interesting things about this particular paragraph, it is found elsewhere. It is found in the sutta where the Buddha talks about his ascetic practices before his awakening. You know about those ascetic practices? The Buddha talks about his life. You know about that? No, you don't know. Okay, you don't know about that. Okay, some of you know about this, some of you don't. So there is that in the story of the Buddha leading up to his awakening, he took on board the teachers that existed at that time, which was obviously a very good thing to do. And one of the things that he took on was the ascetic practices that were very common in ancient India. And some of these ascetic practices were very, very strict, like eating one rice grain a day, that kind of stuff. One rice grain a day is kind of, you can imagine what it looked like after a while. Sometimes you see these Buddha statues. It's actually not a Buddha statue, that's an important point to recognize, where the Buddha is completely emaciated. Have you seen those? It is not the Buddha, remember that. Next time you see it is not the Buddha. It is before the Buddha, it's the Buddha to be, he's still practicing. That's why he's so emaciated. He's got wrong view. It's the wrong view statue. Wrong view statue, okay? Because he's still trying to understand. He still has the wrong ideas. And it is actually found in the suttas where the Buddha says, me too, before my awakening, I had wrong view. I thought, happiness was to be had through suffering, etc. So part of those ascetic practices, like all of these things, part of that was to do this kind of practice, beating down mind with mind. Another one was holding his breath. So he would hold his breath until he had these massive pains and things going through his body, going through his head. Some really extreme things. And in there, it is said to be the wrong practice. So how can it be wrong practice and right practice at the same time? That doesn't make any sense. Yeah, it's either wrong or right. It can't be both. What do you think? Yeah. Okay, no, I'm just being silly. It's fun that you're engaging. I really like that, actually. That's really nice. Very nice of you. But the idea is that that some things can be right in one context and wrong in another context.
So violence is right in certain contexts.
Not violence. This is about this suppressing the mind with mind. That's what this is about.
It's not
It's not well. It's it can maybe be considered a kind of violence towards yourself, but it's not kind of what we normally probably consider violence. It's just like suppressing your mind, forcing your mind, basically. That's really what it is, using willpower. And that willpower, if it is used as a exclusive path to awakening, then it is a problem. That was done by other sects and it was wrong. And it doesn't lead to awakening itself. But when it's used as part of a larger system, as the final desperate measure when nothing else works, well, then it may be acceptable, right? So this is kind of the point here, is that within this particular system, it makes kind of sense, yeah, when you are very, very desperate. But it's not in itself a path to awakening. These are the kind of things that are discussed by Buddhist scholars. You will be surprised that people write academic articles on these things. Yeah, is this a real Buddhist teaching? Is it an infiltration by some other sect at a later point? What actually is it? But the idea is that on very, very occasionally, it may be okay to use suppression as a technique, but we have to be very careful with this. Sometimes this works, and when that works, the bad thoughts are given up. And then actually, if it works correctly, your mind is stilled internally. It is settled, unified, and becomes immersed in samadhi. In other words, you actually are able to not just to suppress the mind, but to actually eliminate the defilements, and then the samadhi, the meditation happens. But this brings up a very interesting point. If this teaching here is really a wrong teaching at the outset, that is not part of the path to awakening, that is maybe part of other religions like Jainism or whatever, where they use much more force and willpower, it comes to the very interesting question of what we were asking yesterday. Yeah, this was the last question yesterday that I refused to answer. And I thought maybe now is a good time to answer this question, because it's a very important question, and I really want to touch on this. Let me come to the end of the sutta first of all, because finish this particular sutta off, then I'll come to it. Then the Buddha says, now take the mendicant who is focusing on some foundation of meditation that gives rise to bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion. Yeah, they focus on some other foundation of meditation connected with the skillful. So this is the first method, where you shift your viewpoint from the seeing the bad qualities in the person, yeah, if we're looking at the person, to the good qualities. First method. If that doesn't work, they examine the drawbacks in those thoughts, the danger of ill will. You understand the danger and the suffering in that. If that doesn't work, they try to ignore and forget those thoughts. You just stay with the breath and you kind of ignore those thoughts. You leave them in the background. If that doesn't work, you focus on stopping the formation of the thoughts, the will, the intention that is the driver of the thinking. You just watch, you are passive, and you allow it to die down. And if that doesn't work, then with your teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, they squeeze, squash, and torture mind with mind. Not sure about torture mind with mind. It's more like controlling mind with mind. Anyway, I won't get into that now. When they succeed in each of these things, those bad thoughts are given up and come to an end. The mind becomes still internally, is settled, unified, and becomes immersed in samadhi. This is called a mendicant, who is a master of the ways of thought. They will think what they want to think, and they won't think what they don't want to think. Yeah, so that is obviously the purpose of the sutta, becoming a master of the ways of thought, always thinking what you want to think. Is that nice? Yeah, never having a thought of ill will if you don't want that. Or if you want to think, we don't really want to have ill will if we can avoid it. So you always have a control of your mind. You're always kind of leaning towards compassion, kindness, always giving up things that are lesser, lower, moving to the higher things in life. This is really what this is about. So this kind of gives us a sense of being in charge of ourselves. And this is, I think, is one of those things that is very unpleasant in life, when it feels like we're not really in charge. It feels like our conditioning is in charge. Our habits are in charge. Our background is in charge. Yeah, the thoughts that come back into our minds because we were traumatized maybe when we were young or something like that. Yeah, memories from our, everyone has memories from the past coming in, interfering with our present. It is as if we are out of control in a certain sense. So how does this control actually arise? And one of the beautiful words you find in the suttas, you find the idea of sati adipatteya. And sati is mindfulness. And adipatteya means like you are in charge. Yeah, you are the boss. You are empowered through sati, is this idea. So if mindfulness is very powerful, it means that you are in charge of yourself. And so the idea here is that you are controlling your mind, but that controlling of the mind in this way relies on the empowerment through sati. So you have to have very powerful mindfulness to be able to do this. And if you have very powerful mindfulness, if you're kind of fully aware all the time, knowing what's going on, it means that you are in charge of your life. This is what mindfulness does. It makes you feel in charge of yourself. You don't feel anymore that you're kind of being ruled by these unruly habits and this, you know, the mind which is out of control. You feel in charge. And this is one of the beautiful consequences of mindfulness. Yeah, because when bad things happen, because you're mindful, you're able to take action to lead your mind in a different direction, to think differently, to perceive differently, to speak differently, whatever it is. So mindfulness makes you feel in charge. And that's kind of nice to feel in charge. Yeah, what does it? I mean, we could discuss the philosophical meanings of what it means to be in charge, but at least you feel that way. You feel in control of your life, in control of your mind, and you can really lead your life as you think it is appropriate. There's even a higher way of being in charge. It's called the samadhi adipatteya, because samadhi is even higher mental faculty, yeah? And samadhi is when the mind is very focused. Not only are you present, but you're present in a focused way. Because the more focused the mind is, it's an even higher ability to wield the mind whatever way you want. And this is why in the suttas it always goes to the jhana states, first, second, third or fourth jhana, and then that makes the mind wieldy and workable. Yeah, the mind is flexible. Whatever you tell the mind will do. It will follow orders just like that. So this is the idea of, again, feeling in complete charge of yourself. The hindrances, the defilements of the mind, they make the mind unwieldy. They block the mind, stop the mind from really being flexible and doing what you want. So this is kind of the idea here. So it's attractive, right? To feel in control of yourself rather than always being under the control of all of these other things in the mind. So this is what this sutta is about. Now, then comes another last phrase in the sutta. And this very last phrase says, after they think what they want to think, it says, they have cut off craving, untied the fetters, and by rightly comprehending conceit, have made an end of suffering here. So this last sentence, what that means is that they have become an arahant. They have gone all the way to the end of the path. That's what cutting off conceit means, yeah? And you have become fully enlightened or awakened at this very last stage. But the sutta doesn't really seem to be about that. The sutta seems to be about knowing how to deal with the thoughts, right? That's what the sutta really seems to be about. So this last bit on the end there seems like maybe it doesn't fit. And what is interesting about this is that when you read the parallel to this sutta in Chinese translation, it doesn't have that last sentence. And then you think maybe that is more original. Because it is the way that the suttas work. It's very often the case that if something isn't complete, it's very easy to add something, right? You add something, okay, we're going to complete the sutta, so it goes all the way to arahantship. But actually deleting something which you think is the word of the Buddha, that's kind of a bit more dodgy. So things have a tendency to be added. And one reason why things are sometimes added is because all of these suttas, they have commentaries with it. And during the period of oral transmission, when these suttas were transmitted orally, they were spoken, and the commentary would be spoken alongside the actual sutta. And you can imagine if the commentary is spoken alongside the sutta, it's very easy to mix up the two. And sometimes commentarial material intrudes into the suttas and become part of the suttas over time. So this is how sometimes there is a little bit of corruption, of contamination, if you like, of the suttas in this way. This can happen. And so I'm bringing this point up because now that brings us to this question beautifully, right? You can see the seamless transition, yeah? So the question is to remind you what the question is again. What are some details of the origins of the suttas? When were they first written down in Pali? How can we be sure that they are the word of the Buddha? So these are all very interesting questions, and anyone who is serious about understanding the Dhamma should look into these kind of questions because they are significant. And this is something that I have also looked quite a lot into. In fact, there is a booklet that some of you perhaps have read, I don't know, called The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Text. Adam, you have read it? Yeah? Some of you have read it? Wow, okay. Yeah. That's wonderful. I'm very glad that people have read this book. If you haven't read it, read it. I shall certainly be so kind. The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts. Yeah?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and my name is on that book because I'm a co-author of the book. So there was Bhante Sujato and myself, we did that project together. It was his idea, and I said, yes, sir, I'll follow along and work with you. So we did that. And there in that book, we kind of go through some of the evidence for whether what we have is the authentic word of the Buddha or not. And just to let you know, it's very hard sometimes maybe to know what quality it is. Yeah, I mean, you don't know me, whether I'm kind of trustworthy in these kind of academic fields or whatever. Yeah, this is getting slightly academic. Yeah. But one of the people who really praised that book, that's kind of interesting, is a fellow called Richard Gombrich. And Richard Gombrich, he was the professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University for about 30 years. Yeah, he's one of the top scholars in the field of of Indian languages, and also expert on Buddhism at the same time. So he said that was, from his point of view, that was one of the best books written. I actually said the best book written on that particular subject. That's what he said. So just to give a kind of because sometimes it's hard to know whether it's good or not. But anyway, that's what he said, just to give some kind of, whatever. So let's look a little bit at this question here. So the origins of the suttas, so they, as you obviously have gathered here, they originated in an oral culture, right? And the writing down in the Pali is said to have happened about the year 60 BC. So that's 2,100 years ago or something, around the year 60 BC. In a place called the Alu Vihara in Sri Lanka. Have you heard about the Alu Vihara? No? Have you heard about the Alu Vihara? You have. Wow, there you are. So this is nice about having people with backgrounds from these countries. You know some of these things. So the Alu Vihara is written about, I think, in the Mahavamsa or something like that. The Mahavamsa is the great chronicle of Sri Lanka, which talks about the Sri Lankan history and Buddhism in Sri Lanka. It's a very interesting document, and it has a lot of this information in there. So that is where, according to tradition, the Pali Canon was written down at the very first time, right? So is that accurate or not? Can we know that that is actually what happened? Well, quite likely some of it was written down a little bit before, but this may have been the formalization of that writing down. Yeah, it happened at the Alu Vihara. That is only for the Pali Canon. Then there are many other versions of the Buddhist canon, many other different schools, right? And they would have been written down in other places. So very interesting, if you look at some of the history in the north of India, we're talking about present-day Afghanistan, Pakistan, or the north of India itself, and they have found some earthenware vases. It's kind of in large kind of, earthenware things with lids and things sealed up. And inside these things, sometimes they find Buddhist manuscripts. And some of these Buddhist manuscripts have been dated to almost 2,000 years old. Isn't that kind of astonishing? And so these still exist. Yeah, of course, when you can imagine taking those things out, they're 2,000 years old. You have to be, they are like, if you touch them, they turn to dust, bang, like that, right? Because they're so incredibly fragile. So you need to have experts, you know, to say the least, and who actually then deal with these manuscripts. And they're able, I don't know how they do it, but they're able to somehow conserve them and then look at the age and find out that they are 2,000 years old. And then they read the texts. Yeah, these are obviously written in a language completely different from anything, you know, anything we use these days. But these are experts, so they know how to do that. And then they can compare them with the suttas we have now. That's kind of how we start to approach this idea of the age of these texts, right? We compare them to other schools in Buddhism, and then we find out, kind of, do they have anything in common? So it was written down in Pali, but let me go back in time a little bit. So let us go back in time to the time of the Emperor Ashoka. Have you heard about the Emperor Ashoka? Yeah? Emperor Ashoka was the emperor of India. He was the one who ruled over the largest Indian empire in world history. This was about 150, 200 years after the Buddha, so about 260 BC, thereabouts. And he was this incredibly powerful emperor, and he happened to be a Buddhist, which is kind of really fascinating. He actually converted to Buddhism. Before that, we're not quite sure exactly what he was, but he became a Buddhist during his time as an emperor. And he was this very violent person beforehand. That's how he ended up with a large empire. It's a bit of a shame that you have to be violent to have a large empire, but that's what happened. Very violent. And then he changed completely and became the most peaceful person. I think it is said that he has incredible amount of remorse for all the things he did. Very slaughtered so many people, and he realized he'd done a massive mistake. So he felt remorse, and then he kind of went to the Buddhists and found a way. Well, how can I purify this a little bit? Okay, I better practice, do the right thing. And then he changed around, and he became an example of a Buddhist ruler. He would stop slaughter of animals. He would do all kind of things in his society. There was capital punishment, I think, was abolished. I can't remember now. We know these things because these things were inscribed in what is called the Ashokan Pillars. So if you travel to India, you can see these Ashokan Pillars sometimes in the present day. This is a really remarkable thing, that these stone columns that were erected, they're like really tall, like 10 meters, 11 yards or whatever, Really tall, at 10 meters? Is it that tall? Can't remember now, but they're really, really tall. And they're planted in the earth, and then they are inscribed. And of course, stone pillars that are inscribed like that, they last a very long time. So in the present day, we can go and you can actually read what it says on those stone pillars. And they were inscribed in language called the Brahmi language. And the Brahmi language is a precursor to the current language of India, or the writing in India, which is called Devanagari. Devanagari means city of the Devas. So it's kind of a nice name for a language, the city of the Deva, city of the gods. And so that is a precursor to that. And you can see the evolution of that language from the Brahmi characters gradually evolving to become the present-day Devanagari characters. So they can be read. And there you can see the things that were spoken by the Emperor Ashoka, the kind of commands he gave to his empire on how to treat animals, how to treat people, how to have respect for all the ascetics and Brahmins, the various religions, and all of these kind of things. All of that is there on the pillars. We should respect all religions. It was very beautiful the way it was done. But he was a Buddhist, and because he was a Buddhist, he was very keen on spreading the Buddhist message. This is kind of, especially when you are new to Buddhism, you become very kind of, this is the best, I've got to spread it. I remember what it was like when I was a young monk, I was fanatic. And that maybe Ashoka also was a bit fanatic in those early days, right? Fanatically spreading the Buddhist message. And so during this time, there was a large kind of a migration, if you like, of Buddhism all over India. And one of those people that was sent out was Mahinda. We talked about Mahinda the other day, Mahinda was the son of Ashoka, and he went to Sri Lanka. And that's why I was saying that the shorter sutta on the elephant's footprint was taught in Sri Lanka by Mahinda. And that was the beginning of the Pali tradition, all the way to the south of the Indian subcontinent in Sri Lanka. But then there were other schools that were also established at this time. There was this migration of Buddhism. And so the Sarvastivadin school, as one of the very famous schools of ancient India, went to the north of India, to what is now Kashmir. Yeah, Kashmir in the very, very north. That is where they had their stronghold. And there were other schools like the Dharmaguptaka. They went to Gandhara, which is present-day Pakistan, and that sort of area. And there were other schools again, Mahasanghikas, which apparently stayed mostly in central India, in Bodh Gaya or Patna, that area. Mahishasakas. There were supposed to be 18 schools in the early Buddhism. And that number is a little bit unclear because it's kind of hard to define a school very precisely, but something like that. And that school, the Sarvastivadin school, that was in the north of India, what is now Kashmir, right? And then you had the school in Sri Lanka. These were two of the main schools. So the school that was in the north of India, those monks and nuns who lived there, they took those teachings and they started traveling with those teachings. They went even further north. And further north, beyond Kashmir, you find the Silk Road. Yeah, you know the Silk Road? The Silk Road is this ancient trade route that went all the way from Europe all the way to China. Yeah, this was where Marco Polo went when he, you know, this Italian explorer back in the 12th century, he went all the way from Europe to China. He walked along the Silk Road. It's a very ancient trade route. And so they would go up. Are you okay with all of this? I'm supposed to talk suttas, but I'm kind of going on now, like, okay. Please tell me off if I go too far. Yeah. So they get onto the Silk Road. They find the merchants, yeah, and they get on the caravans, and the caravans start to take them along the Silk Route. And eventually they come to China, because the Silk Route goes to China, right? And they go in China, they go to the capital cities, Xi'an, Luoyang. This is where you find the very famous caves, the Longmen Caves in China. These are very famous and beautiful caves, Buddhist caves you find there. And so they brought Buddhism to China. And this way, the Sarvastivadin school got established in China. The text got translated from Sanskrit, because Sanskrit was the language used by the Sarvastivadins, translated from Sanskrit into Chinese. This is ancient Chinese, right? The Chinese, or it's called Middle Chinese to be precise. The Chinese that existed 1,500 years ago. And so in China, we have preserved most of the text of the Sarvastivadin school in Chinese characters. And then in Sri Lanka, you have most of the text preserved in Sinhala characters, right? In ancient Lagada, that's the Pali canon. So you have two different canons that separated around the time of Ashoka. And they have been very, very long distance apart from the very beginning. Kashmir to Sri Lanka is about 3,000 kilometers. When it goes to China, it is much, much more, obviously. This enormous long period of separation. And then you take these suttas. Yeah, you look at these suttas and you compare them, because they are both supposed to be canons. They both say that they go back to this person called the Buddha. Yeah, that's what they claim to do. And then so we should be able to compare them and see if they are the same, right? And when you do that, what you find is that a certain part of the suttas are almost exactly or very, very closely the same, even after all that time apart. Yeah, so you can take certain things, like, for example, certain formulas that you find in the suttas everywhere, like the jhana formula, for example. The jhana formula has a very standard way of being expressed. Viviceva kamehi, vivica akusalehi damehi, savitakang savicharang, etc. This is the kind of the first jhana formula. You take that, and then you take the one in Chinese, and you kind of put the Chinese into English or whatever, and you compare them, and they are the same. That's kind of extraordinary, right? That's really amazing. This has been separated for 2,200 years, translated into different languages, and they are still the same. Not everything is the same. Occasionally things have been added. Occasionally things have been corrupted, right? But the teachings that are really important and critical, the teachings that you find everywhere in the suttas, have been basically preserved almost verbatim. Not quite verbatim, but all very close to being verbatim, especially in certain cases. And that's kind of really extraordinary. What that shows us, I think, it shows us that the schools were very conservative. They considered these texts to be extremely important. We're going to have to look after them with the greatest care possible. And so that's what they did, and they were obviously successful with that. And now when we compare them, actually they turn out still to be almost the same after 2,200 years. And so when we look back in time, when we go back to 2,300 years, that time was still in the oral period, and the oral period lasted for another couple hundred years after that, until it was written down in 60 BC or whatever. There's about 200 years gap. So after the school separated, it was still inside the oral period of transmission. And what that shows is that even during the oral period, these things were transmitted with great fidelity. There wasn't really much loss, even during that period. So oral transmission, if it is done well, can be done to a very, very high standard, a very high... this is because in India at that time, they already knew how to transmit text orally, because this was part of the ancient Brahmanical tradition, and they were very successful at these things, and so it was successful here as well. And of course, if we agree that they were so successful in transmitting these texts for 2,200 years or whatever, because they were very conservative in their outlook, then why wouldn't they also be conservative for the last 200 years, going back to the time of the Buddha himself, right? There's only maybe a couple of hundred years now missing from the time of separation of the schools to the time of the Buddha himself. So presumably that conservatism was built into the tradition, and they were always very conservative, right? So this is how you start to know what are the early suttas, whether they came from the Buddha or not. In fact, when you go to the early text, and we saw that before when we looked at the great sutta on the Buddha's passing away, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it is kind of part of the tradition from the very beginning. Learn these texts, memorize them. In other places it says, if you disagree in the meaning, come together and sort it out. The idea is, these things are important. Make sure you keep them properly. This is laid down from the very beginning, and it seems to have been followed by the tradition. Be conservative. Look after them properly. So,
The explanation for the contamination of the text is based on conjecture.
Say again?
Is it conjecture?
What is a conjecture?
The contamination of the text at some point, is it because it's contamination with the commentary?
So when I said before that it's contamination of the text, it's because I say that if you compare these suttas, and one is and they're slightly different, one of them must have been contaminated somehow. Otherwise, presumably, because if they have the same source, which presumably they have, they all say they come from the Buddha. At some point, one has become different than the other one. There is some known reasons. One of them is the commentaries intruding into the text. That's one reason. Other ones, probably sometimes maybe faulty memorization. Yeah, that's another one. In Sri Lanka, there were certain books that were only memorized by very few people. And of course, if only very few people memorize it, one person can make a mistake and there's no one to correct them anymore, right? Because there's only one person left. So these are the sort of things that can lead to contamination. Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of people knowing them, but remember there was a lot of texts as well, and texts were always expanding, right? There was always more and more texts. So there came a point when it became difficult to memorize all of these things. And then there were different schools, right? 18 schools, they all had different texts, and the text expanded. And of course, there comes a point when it becomes very unwieldy, the whole thing. And I think that's why they eventually decided to write it down, because it was so unwieldy. So I think when you do the calculation about how many people there were to recite each text, it turns out to be not that many, because even though there were lots of monastics, but it was the monastics who learned these texts, Still, there were so many texts that still it took tens of thousands of monastics to keep this thing going, yeah, because there was so much of it. So every monastic was supposed to learn some texts because that was kind of how you knew what was going on. That's how you actually knew the word of the Buddha. But not everyone was a kind of a proper reciter. Banaka is the Pali word. Banaka means a textual reciter. Yeah. So this is how roughly we know that what we have is the word of the Buddha. Yeah, that that this is how the tradition has worked. And I think sometimes there is too much skepticism in the world about these things, and sometimes I think it's unwarranted because there is a very strong evidence, as far as I can tell, that the tradition has been very conservative. And this comparative study, comparing the texts from various schools, etc., it points in one direction. And so, I mean, of course, there's always going to be contamination of these ancient texts, but it's still the main teachings, the things that really matter, are there. Yeah. So we are, in a sense, in the presence of the Buddha. So you read the suttas, that is still the case. This is actually the Buddha's transmission to us. All right, so now I have answered that question as well. So I've gone a bit over time, but maybe let's do a little bit of meditation together here. Okay. Okay. All right. Does anyone have any questions or comments about this? Please, yeah.
Is there a curated collection of early Buddhist texts? Does anyone?
Curated collection. There is one curated collection that is called In the Buddha's Words by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. That's highly curated. It's kind of put into nice sections, certain topics, and then it's introduced, and then it has nice footnotes on the end explaining what's going on. And it's by, I would say, the number one translator of Buddhist texts in the world. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, American monk, lives in New York, just south of here. You know him? Yeah, you know him. Okay, so good.
Yeah. Are there parts that aren't as early? Is that, are they?
Okay, yeah, but these are early texts. That, you know, one of the kind of nice conclusions about that comes out all of this research is that if you rely on the four main Nikayas of the Pali, the Digha Nikaya, Middle Length Sayings, Connected and Numerical Sayings, then actually you are basically there with the early texts. You know, that's kind of one of the nice results of that. Some of those texts may not be quite authentic, and you won't be able to tell 100% for sure. But as a general principle, you are on safe grounds if you stick to those. I think that's pretty much all you need to know. Because, I mean, if you get really... Are you used to reading suttas? Is that? Yeah, you are? Okay, great. Excellent. So you can go to places like Sutta Central, and you can kind of check out parallels and these sort of things to suttas. There is a very nice study by our local monk down here, Venerable Nalayo, who lives just down here. And he has done a study of the whole middle-length sayings, where he compares every sutta in the middle-length sayings with all other existing versions of that sutta. So if you're interested, you can have a look at that book. I think you just Google, if you just Google the comparative study of the Majjhima Nikaya, something like that, Venerable Bhikkhu Nalayo, and then you should find it online. I think it's available online. Yes, please.
Do you think the Chinese Agamas are worth reading as well, in the translations of them?
The Agamas?
Sorry?
Did you say the Agamas?
It
can be. It can be worthwhile, especially when you kind of, it helps you to compare the Pali version, and that can be quite interesting. The Madhyama Agama, which is the parallel to the Majjhima Nikaya, has been translated in full already. Some of that is available for free online as PDF, so you can just download it. And that's very interesting. And you can see in there many of the suttas in there. It's not exactly the same collection as the Majjhima Nikaya, but maybe about 90 suttas are parallels. And you can compare them, and you can see it, the extent to which they actually are real, are the same or not. And you can learn a lot from that, actually. And there are some of the things that I always found very interesting is like the sutta I mentioned before called the Chaitanya Sutta, which talks about, you start off with a sila, morality. From sila comes non-regret, from non-regret comes gladness comes piti, the rapture, from rapture comes the tranquility comes bliss, from bliss comes samadhi. Those kind of sequences, you compare them, they are exactly the same, in these things. There's not, verbatim the same. And so that's what I meant by some of the most important things in the suttas. Some of the kind of core teachings of the Buddha, which are like the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, the 37 aids to awakening. These critical things tend to be... You wouldn't be able to tell which one is which, basically. Except that one has Chinese characters, the other one has Sinhala character, maybe. But, so that's kind of really, to me, very interesting here. Yes, please, sir. Yeah.
No, I don't have a question.
No, Hong, yeah.
So, the name of the sutta, you say Vitaka, is that the word for thought?
Yeah.
Okay.
Vitakka Santana Sutta.
In the description of the first jhana, there was also
Vitakka
Vichara.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not thought,
right?
There's some complication.
Yeah. It's like, I think it's, we can get back to that later on. This is kind of, I think, an important subject in many ways. But the idea of vitakka, I mean, thoughts don't never overlap completely. You know, words don't overlap completely in one language to another one. So if the word vitakka, you have to translate it somehow. And the best translation may be thought. It doesn't mean that it is an exact translation in all situations. Yeah, because words don't overlap in that way, one-to-one, from one language to another one. It just doesn't. That's not how languages work. They have a slightly different scope in one language compared to another one. For example, you know, a word like chariot in ancient India would refer to those chariots they had at that time, and they would have been slightly different from what we have now, and they would have a maybe broader range or more narrow range, and so things change. The same thing with words like vitakka or many, many other words. They will be slightly different. So this is the danger of, I think, of relying on English translations, is that sometimes you don't really get a full grasp of the Pali word behind it by relying on English translations sometimes. And there's, you know, usually when the word vitakka occurs, well, it would translate as thought, because normally it means thought. But what about those situations where it doesn't mean precisely thought, but something else? Do we then give it a different translation? Or do we keep thought as a translation for consistency? What do we do in those situations? This is the kind of the conundrum of translators, which makes it quite hard to translate sometimes. So, all right. Anyone else? Yeah, please.
Regarding like the books, like the Book of Eight and the Dhammapada, clearly there's a different kind of flavor to those.
Sutta Nipata, yeah. Book chapter 8, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Tathagata, yeah.
Why do you think the difference is? Is it's not that it's an earlier teaching per se, just that if it's transmitted in a different way or something?
Yeah, I mean, these are pure verse collections, right? They're purely made of verse, and there's no prose at all to the Atthakavagga. And so they were basically things that were spoken, you know, out of inspiration at a particular time, at a particular place. So they are a peculiar collection in that sense, because almost all other collections, if there is verse, the verse often comes with prose, right? There's a prose and there's a verse which kind of... solidifies the prose version, kind of by restating it, but stating it in verse form instead. So this is quite kind of a unique collection, in that it's just about verse. So this would have been maybe the Buddha or some sages at that time, Buddhist sages, who would have spoken things out of inspiration very often. You do find that in certain suttas, in the Sutta Sanghita Nikaya as well. We find monastics who speak things out of being out of pure inspiration, etc. So there's a bit overlap here. Some of the suttas in the Sanghita Nikaya have a similar kind of flavor to them as what we find in the Atthakavagga. So it's not entirely unique, but it is partly different. I must admit, I haven't really studied them close enough to enable me to say to what extent they are really different. You have to study things like vocabulary, and ideas expressed, and grammatical endings, and these kind of things, and it takes quite a lot of research to really do this thoroughly. If you just go by the superficial English translation, you might get the wrong idea about these things. So the answer is uncertain, but they fit roughly, as far as I'm concerned, roughly with the ideas expressed elsewhere, but they are more limited. They don't express the full set of ideas, because in verse it is very hard to express lists of ideas and these kind of things. That is much more easily expressed in prose than it is in verse. For that reason, it does have a different flavor. Anyway, okay, shall we carry on? Okay. So we have now come to the point. We have been looking at various ways of overcoming the unskillful thoughts. Yeah, and one of the things that is important with this, what I've been trying to kind of make the point, is that wisdom is a core aspect of how to deal with these things. So, and also one of the points I've been trying to make is the idea that ill will is often the most important defilement, because it really is problematic, and it is so destructive in so many ways for the spiritual path and for anything really. And so what we want to do now is to look in more detail about how to overcome ill will. What are the strategies? What is kind of the wisdom way? What are some wise ways of thinking about ill will and dealing with situations when we come into them? And this next sutta is precisely about that. It's called Getting Rid of Resentment. It's quite a well-known sutta in the Pali Canon. It's kind of a thing that you will hear in monasteries, Agata Pativinaya Sutta. It is found in the numerical discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, the fifth chapter of the fives, sutta number 162. And this sutta is spoken by Venerable Sariputta. You all heard about Venerable Sariputta? Yeah? Yeah? So you have the Buddha's kind of two most senior disciples, Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Mahamoggallana, and usually they are on either side of the Buddha statue. But here we have a nun on the side. This is probably Kuan Yin. Yeah, so we have Kuan Yin. This place is more kind of different traditions coming together. But if you go to a traditional Theravadan monastery, you wouldn't usually find Kuan. Actually, sometimes you do find Kuan Yin even in Theravada monasteries. You have all kinds of deities and all kind of things. But very often you would then have Venerable Sariputta on one side, Venerable Mahamoggallana on the other side. Do you know how to tell the difference between Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana? No?
They have different shade of skin.
Different shade of skin? Maybe, but not usually, not always. I'm not sure. You think one is more dark than the other or something?
I think that's how they portray them in like statues.
Okay.
Just to give away, uh-huh.
Okay, maybe that's one way of doing it, but they're not always. Sometimes they look exactly the same, actually, so it probably varies a bit.
Is one always on right and one always on left?
Yeah, but how do you know which one to put on the right and which one to put on the left? Because you had to know which one is which first, right? Otherwise you can't put the right one on the right, yeah? So this is iconography, right? How do we know icons from each other? And then the way you know this is that almost all the disciples of the Buddha, they have their hands in Anjali, right, like this. This is kind of the sign of being a disciple. So they always, you will see that, you see a large number of disciples, everyone has their hands in Anjali, except one person. And this is the Venerable Sariputta. He does not have his hands in Anjali. He has his hands like this. He kind of has this confident look about him, right? It's kind of nice. And you kind of almost like guess that this must be Venerable Sariputta when you see that. So that's how you know. So when you come to a Buddhist shrine and you see they have got it all wrong, which is very common, you can go and rearrange the shrine for them. Make yourself very popular by rearranging the shrine. Okay, sorry, you got it all wrong. I know how this works. So that's how you basically usually tell these things apart. And the color, I didn't know that the coloring was different, but that might be another way they actually do that sometimes. Sometimes in monastery these days, they also have some of the nuns as well. When I went to Venerable Ayatatalokas monastery in California, she had nuns there as well, and they were specially made in Cambodia, and she had imported them. And they looked pretty much exactly like the monks, but they had a slightly female shape to them. And they were, so they looked, so that was kind of nice. And she told the story that because she's quite close to Spirit Rock. You know about Spirit Rock, right? Yeah, yeah. Spirit Rock is kind of the big center in California, just north of San Francisco. And they had told her, she had asked them, how come you have all this, Kuan Yin and Tara and all of these kind of Mahayana statues everywhere? And then they had responded, well, because there is no, in Theravada, there is no sacred feminine. Yeah, the sacred feminine only exists in Mahayana. And she said, nonsense. There's lots of sacred feminine Theravada. What about all the arahant bhikkhunis that exist at the time of the Buddha? They are sacred feminine. And so she had some maid in Cambodia, right, for her monastery, which is kind of cool. So sometimes I think that is kind of, we can do that. You can, because these statues are very, they can all look pretty much the same, yeah, because they don't really have any much personal characteristics anyway. We don't know what these people look like. So we can actually make these feminine statues as well in Buddhism. It doesn't have to be Kuan Yin. It can be Venerable Upalavanna, Venerable Kema, some of these famous female disciples of the Buddha. They were considered his two main female disciples was Kema and Upalavanna. So slightly, roughly parallel to Venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana. Anyway, so this is Venerable Sariputta, and he is considered by the Buddha to be number two after the Buddha himself in terms of wisdom. And he says that if the Buddha is not able to teach the Dhamma, then Venerable Sariputta should take charge and teach the Dhamma instead. Right? So he takes over. Known as the general of the Dhamma, sometimes, Venerable Sariputta. Not sure if I like these war metaphors, but anyway, that's kind of what you sometimes find. Dhamma Senapati. And so this is what he has to say, how to deal with resentment, in other words, basically ill will, etc., etc. So there, Venerable Sariputta addressed the mendicants. Reverends and mendicants, reverend, they replied, and Sariputta said this. Reverends, a mendicant should use these five methods to completely get rid of resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? In the case of a person whose behavior by way of body is impure, but whose behavior by way of speech is pure, you should get rid of resentment for that kind of person. In the case of a person whose behavior by speech is impure, but whose behavior by body is pure, you should get rid of resentment for that kind of person too. In the case of a person whose behavior by body and speech are impure, but who gets an opening and clarity of the heart from time to time, you should get rid of resentment for that kind of person. In the case of a person whose behavior by way of body and speech is impure, and he does not get an openness and clarity of the heart from time to time, still, you should get rid of resentment for that kind of person. In the case of a person whose behavior by body and speech is pure, and who gets an openness and clarity of the heart from time to time, you should get rid of resentment for that kind of person. So, five kind of people. Do you see anyone missing from that list? I have bad news. There is no one missing from that list. You cannot really, if you're going to follow the Buddha's teaching, you cannot harbor resentment towards anyone. Even your most favorite enemy cannot have resentment towards your favorite enemy. As people really get a bit upset when they hear that, because they don't want to get rid of resentment towards some people sometimes. So that's kind of good news, right? It really is good news, the fact that we shouldn't really have resentment or ill will towards anyone. And I think obviously all of you get that already. So what that means is that even though other people may not like us, may find us difficult, may have problems with us, whatever it is, we don't have any ill will for anyone in the world. We don't have any enemies. That is kind of the Buddhist approach to the world. So whatever other people do, that's their problem. Our job is not to have any enemies in this world. That doesn't mean that you necessarily engage with everyone or necessarily put yourself in harm's way. Of course you don't do that. It just means that you don't have, even if you withdraw a little bit, you don't do that out of ill will or out of the wrong kind of motivation. And that's a beautiful way of living. It's living in the way where we have no ill will against anyone, where we have a sense of feeling that our whole world is our friend in a certain way. It's a beautiful way of living one's life. And it means that when you come down to sit on your meditation cushion, because there's nothing there, very few hindrances in the mind. It makes it relatively easy then to do the meditation practice. You don't have any enemies. You don't have any problems with people in the world. You understand how to forgive. You understand how to let go. You understand how to have compassion for everyone. So there's no exemptions on this list. So the reason why there is a list is because the way we deal with different people is slightly different. That's why there is a list, and that's why five different kinds of people are mentioned here. And you already have some idea of why that is the case. We discussed this yesterday. We're going to discuss this now in more detail. So this is a typical kind of pedagogical method that is used in the suttas and used by modern teachers as well. Yeah, you kind of make a summary first of all, and then you go into the details next. So let's go into the details. So Venerable Bodhisariputta, he says the following. How should you get rid of resentment for a person whose behavior by body is impure, but whose behavior by speech is pure? Suppose a mendicant wearing rag robe sees a rag by the roadside. They would hold it down with the left foot, spread it out with the right foot, tear out what is intact, and take it away with them. In the same way, at that time, you should ignore that person's impure behavior by way of body and focus on their pure behavior by way of speech. That is how to get rid of resentment for that person. Very simple, right? And this is what we've been talking about all the time, and here kind of it is spelled out without any ambiguity, really. So if you see some bad behavior in a person or bad qualities in a person, you change your focus and you look at the good qualities instead. I don't think we need to be too concerned or detained about this distinction between body and speech. That is not so important, yeah? The idea is just that there are different qualities in individuals, good qualities, bad qualities. And sometimes we just shift our focus from the good one, from the bad ones, from the bad ones to the good ones. I was going to give you some very bad advice there, but I stopped myself just in time. So from the bad ones to the good ones, yeah, and that is really enough to kind of bang, let go of that bad quality. And as I mentioned before, to be able to do this, what we have to do, one of the things that we have to do is we have to have self-knowledge. We really have to understand our own minds. We have to understand our problems. What are the people in the world that we find difficult? Yeah, and sometimes, meditation can just be observing your own mind. Yeah, sometimes you do walking meditation. You go back and forth, and this can be a good time to observe one's mind, and just become familiar with yourself. Become familiar with your defilements. Sometimes in life. Your big defilements, we will always know our big defilements, but the more subtle things can be more difficult to catch sometimes when you're very busy or whatever. Sometimes it can be good just to be with yourself, observe what are the issues I've got, what are the people that I have problems with, and start knowing yourself. And then, of course, you can put these things into action once you know where the problems are. So know the people in your life who you find a little bit difficult, but who still have good qualities, yeah? And then you build up those good qualities in your mind. You remind yourself that what a wonderful thing it is that they even have any good qualities, right? Do we have the right to expect that people have good qualities? Of course not. If you look at the world, you see all the difficult things going on, it's a miracle that anyone has any good qualities sometimes. I'm exaggerating a bit, but anyway, you know the idea. Yeah, all the kind of problems going on, you watch TV or read the news and you kind of, it's enough to get depressed and become a serial killer if you see some of these things. And of course, we're not all serial killers. Hooray, we're not all serial killers. So sometimes you just acknowledge the fact that there is a lot of goodness in the world. Yeah, you start looking around, you see people coming on retreats like this. You look at ordinary people treating each other well. As a monk, it is wonderful when I go back to my monastery in Perth and I am with my fellow monks. They are far from perfect, but they are very well intentioned. They're trying to live according to some of the highest principles that we can live according to as human beings. And so I look at my fellow monks, I think, yes, occasionally you irritate me, but actually, you're wonderful human beings. Why should I allow that tiny little things to upset me or to become a source of irritation or ill will? So you just let go of that very quickly because you know the big picture. And the same is true of a group like this. The same is true if you have many Kalyanamittas in your life. You know the expression Kalyanamitta? Good friends, yeah, spiritual friends, right? Very important expression in Buddhism. These are our spiritual friends, starting with the Buddha and then everyone else who helps you. The opposite of Kalyanamitta is Papamitta, bad friends. Don't have too many of those. Have mostly good friends, good spiritual friends. So that is, and because of that, because these are good people, you can build up that perception of goodness in these people. Remind yourself again and again. Remind yourself how wonderful it is that these things exist in the world. And actually, there's a lot of good people in this world. Don't watch the news too much, because the news are going to drag you down. Yeah, and they are not realistic, even remotely, what happens in the world. Remind yourself that ordinary people are often very good-hearted and kind. And then that helps to lift yourself out of the kind of the negative way of thinking or whatever. That also gives you hope. That reduces anxiety, because it gives you hope that the world actually, maybe there is hope for the world. We are, maybe good things can emerge from all this mess that we're in sometimes. And so this is how you build up that thought. And then if there is a particular person who you find difficult, you store that thought in your mind. You store it in your mind, and then when you kind of meet with that person and you see them and you kind of start to feel, okay, a bit of ill will, a bit of bad feelings is arising, okay, pull that thought down, pull that thing down from the shelf in your mind, that perception, and put that onto the person. Okay, now I see the goodness, I remember the goodness in them. Yes, it's so simple. But again, it takes a bit of practice to do this. But after a while, it happens almost automatically. Your freight train, your supertanker, which has this enormous momentum, these are your habits from the past, they are changing, moving around. It becomes easier and easier to do this kind of thing. So we have this beautiful simile here. This is the mendicant wearing the rag robes. I used to have a rag robe. People told me it was too much. It was one of these robes that there was nothing left of the original robe. It was just this patchwork of different colors and everything. And I traveled around the world in this robe, And people looked at me when I kind of looked slightly shocked when they saw me traveling around the world. I looked like some kind of beggar or something. I was a beggar, I was a monk, so it wasn't too far off. But that was kind of, I really enjoyed that, walking around like this, like I was... with some just rags covering my body. There's something really nice about that, actually. Because the world, we are so important what we wear. We want to wear the right fashions, the right kind of clothes. And when I remember in my own youth, I was really also very fashion conscious in many ways. I think that's kind of part of being young, in my late teens or whatever. It was really important what I was wearing. Actually really nice to let go of all of that, not care at all about what you wear. And that's kind of, it goes against the stream of the world. So people really look at you when you kind of looks like you're wearing a sack of potatoes or something. So that's actually a lot of fun. And we have some monks today in the monastery who wear, and this robe also has a few patches on it. I don't know if you noticed. I'm always proud of my patches because that's the way we're supposed to be as monastics. So some of the monks were rag robe wearers, like I was. And of course, they are going to be on the lookout for rags, right? So they would see a rag by the roadside, or they would find a rag somewhere. And when they find a rag, they are very happy because they can use that to patch the robe when the robe starts to fall apart. And when they then find this rag, they will kind of spread it out. Okay, this part is rotten, this part is too soiled. So they tear those bits off, they fold it up, and they take it with them. And then they use it for sewing their robes later on. And it's like similar kind of thing that we do when we think about the people around us. You look at the person, You see all the qualities, like you spread them out in your mind's eye. You see the good qualities, the bad qualities. You collect the good qualities on one side. You collect the bad qualities on the other side. You tear off along the edge where the good qualities stop and the bad qualities begin. You tear off there. You take the bad qualities. You crumble them up. Yeah, you can imagine this is like written on toilet paper. You put it in the toilet and you flush and you get rid of it once and for all. Yeah, this is bad stuff. It is useless. It is pointless. It is trash. It is not rubbish because I'm in the United States. It's trash. So you put it in the trash or you put it in the toilet and you get rid of it once and for all. And that is a nice way of thinking about that. The idea that seeing the bad things in other people, focusing on that, it's trash, right? It's bad. It is poisonous. It poisons our minds. And then you just get rid of it. And you flush it down and get rid of it once and for all. So this is how this works. So there's a couple of things that I would like to maybe touch on very briefly. And one of the things here, one of the things that is interesting about this story that I always tell at this particular point, and because there are some nice stories in the suttas that you may not have heard before. You may have heard this story if you have listened to me before, but this is especially in the Vinaya Pitaka. The Vinaya Pitaka is the book of the rules for the monastics, how the monastic community operates together and these kind of things. And in there are some stories that are rarely heard in the world, right? Because people read the suttas, not that many people outside of the monastic community read the Vinaya. So one of the stories in the Vinaya is the story of this rag robe wearing monk, yeah? So he goes to the cemetery. It's actually called a charnel ground because this is where you burn the corpses. This is how you did things in Asia in those days and still do it in Asia. If you go to Thailand, you can see people burning corpses. And in the forest monastery where all the Western monks are in Thailand, Wat Nanachat, you heard about Wat Nanachat, Adam? Yeah, you heard about that? Yeah? So this is like well-known where Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Sumedho and many of the Western teachers today, where they started out. And in the monastery, they have the charnel ground, right? Right there in the monastery here. And then when someone dies in the local village, they bring the body to the monastery and they burn it. And the monks will kind of hang around and watch the burning of the body. Yeah, it's a kind of a way just of contemplating the nature of the body, in a sense, contemplating death and these kind of things. So this particular story is a story of this monk who goes to the charnel ground because he is a rag robe wearer. So in the charnel ground, when the corpses are brought into the charnel ground, they're often wrapped in cloth, right, for the sake of modesty or whatever. And then, of course, that cloth is useful for the rag robe wearers, right? So there's a corpse there, yeah, and okay, so you take the cloth from the corpse. And it's important not to wait too long because when the corpse gets old, it gets really disgusting. So you have to take it when it's reasonably fresh. But not too fresh. This is the story, right? So this monk, this corpse has just been brought into the charnel ground, and this monk thinks, yeah, okay, good fresh corpse, good cloth, right? This is this is kind of Buddhist monks, how we talk about it. So this starts, it grabs hold of this cloth, right? Starts pulling it off this body, right? And as he's pulling this cloth off this body, the corpse starts to speak to him, and the corpse says, "Don't take my cloth." And this monk thinks, "Why?" The monk says, "Shut up! You're dead. You don't have any say, right? So be quiet. Just, you know, you don't have any rights or ownership anymore. Once you're dead, that's it. You're finished." So he keeps on pulling off this cloth, right? And he takes the cloth, and then he starts walking away with his cloth. And when he starts walking away, the corpse gets up, right? And he starts walking behind him. This is like the first zombie scene in world history, right? It started in Buddhism. So he walks after this monk, walking after the monk. And the monk kind of sees the zombie, and the monk starts to run, right? Gets back to his cootie, jumps in and slams the door, right? And the zombie just finally comes, and the zombie can't take it any longer and collapses in front of the door of this monk. And the monk goes, "Okay, I made it." So he got that cloth. And then the story goes back to the Buddha, yeah, and the Buddha says, well, yeah, you know, this is kind of the things that maybe you can expect if there's still some consciousness in that body, yeah, maybe it can come alive again, yeah, maybe it's not really dead. And so then the rule is laid down that if you're going to take cloth from a dead body, you have to wait till the body is cold. So these are some of the monastic rules, right? They're pretty interesting rules, right? So if you ever thought the Vinaya was boring, now think again. The Vinaya is very interesting. Lots of fascinating stories there. Yeah. So this is the world's first zombie story, and all Hollywood movies, they are based, I think, ultimately on this particular story. Yeah. It's actually very interesting when you start to read ancient literature, like the Buddhist literature, and you start to realize how many things are recurring tropes in our culture, yeah, or in world culture. Things don't really have a beginning. Sometimes we think that have invented something new. No, actually, it existed 2,500 years ago. And if it had existed 2,500 years ago, it probably existed 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, two eons ago. There's nothing new under the sun, right? Things just keep on recurring again and again. And this is one of the things you feel quite strongly when you read some of these stories. Zombies is an ancient thing here. But another interesting thing, more interesting probably, that emerges, comes out of this, and this is the idea that people sometimes ask me in this kind of situation, well, but if we just focus on the good in people in this way, if we don't look at the bad, are we being realistic? Isn't the purpose of Buddhism to see things in accordance with reality? Aren't we closing our eyes off to the bad qualities in another person? Is this the right way of doing things? And the answer is yes, this is the right thing. And I will try to explain to you why that is the case. And the reason is because people don't really have... we don't know people's character, right? I may see you... we see someone, whatever the person is, and from our point of view, they may seem like a wonderful person. But then there's another person who sees exactly the same person and they don't like them. What is the real person? It is very hard to pin down and know. We can't really say who the real person is, because persons are different in different contexts. They change over time. Yeah, I look at myself. If you had met me 30 years ago, you would have been horrified. Yeah. I've become so civilized over those 30 years. I was probably more like a Viking 30 years ago, straight out of Norway. You can imagine, that's pretty scary. So we change, yeah? And this is kind of part of the parcel for the path. The path is about changing, becoming someone else, purifying ourselves. And because of that, there is no real seeing the other person as they actually are. If there is a real seeing of the person as they actually are, it is more about universal characteristics like impermanence, non-self. These are universal characteristics, not specific characteristics of personality. And so because there is no right personality, because there is no right way of seeing another person, what we have to do instead is not ask, what is that person like? But we have to ask the question, what is the best way of looking at them? What is the most useful way from a spiritual perspective? Yeah, that is what we need to do. And that, of course, is a very different question. And that the answer to that question is to see them in a way that minimizes our personal defilements. And that is by seeing their good qualities. Yeah. So this is really what is important. Because there is no truth anyway, subjective truth. We look for the good qualities in that person. And then we build up something positive inside of us. Of course, sometimes in real life, we have to be careful. This does not mean that we should deny if someone has very bad qualities. Let's say there is a situation of abuse. Yeah, we talked about this very briefly yesterday. We should not deny that. Yeah, but if there is an abusive situation and we have to be careful, we have to withdraw, then we have to learn to look at that abuse in a different way. With most people around us, we can just look at the good qualities. But if something is serious, then we need to take a slightly different approach. Because if we close our eyes to abuse, then we may just be making a difficult situation even worse. So this is the beginning of how to overcome resentment. This is the first method. Yeah, be like the rag robe wearing bhikkhu or bhikkhuni. Look at the good sides, and very often this is a very powerful method. So let's do a little bit more meditation together before we carry on. Okay. All right, so any questions or comments about this? Any questions about the zombies?
Is there a translation, an English translation of the monastic rules where all those stories are?
There is, yeah. I have my personal translation. And I think, yeah, it's true. It's available online. If you go to suttacentral.net, you go to the monastic. Have you been to that website before?
Here and there.
Here and there? Okay.
Yeah.
So if you go to suttacentral.net, you actually find, it is actually my translation, and it's going to be published soon. In Thailand, it's going to be published, and elsewhere as well. It is the whole thing. I think it is the only full translation of the Vinaya Pitaka in existence. There is no other complete translation. It's a translation done by an English lady called I.B. Horner. She did this translation back in the 1930s, but it's not fully complete. So this is the homepage of Sutta Central. Yeah? And so you have the discourses over there, you have the monastic law, and then you have the systematic treatises, which is the Abhidhamma. The middle one is the monastic law. So if you go there, you find all the monastic law, the Theravada school on top, and then you have the various parts of the Theravada Tipitaka right there.
Are you going to publish it in book form, though?
It is going to be published soon. It is being published in Thailand. And also by Sutta Central also is going to publish a version. So it will be published. It's happening in book form. But it's right there on Sutta Central as well. So it's cool, isn't it?
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm really proud of this. Yeah, this is all that. This is the Sutta Central website, and this is what the homepage looks like. Can you see? Yeah, and this is the homepage of suttacentral.net. So if you ever want to read suttas in various, has translations in all kind of languages. This is a really comprehensive website. I mean, really, really super comprehensive. You can read it in Sinhala language as well on this website. You can read it in Norwegian, yeah, seriously, not my translation, but isn't that Norwegian? And then the middle, so this is the suttas over there, and then you have in the middle is the Vinaya Pitaka. These are the monastic rules and regulations, and this is the Abhidhamma over here. So if you, let's say you go to the, you navigate to the monastic rules, the middle one, and here you have the monastic rules of different schools of Buddhism, different ancient schools. Now, the one you're interested in is the Theravada school, which is the top one. The rest ones are just fragments. This is the only one which is complete, the top one. So you go there, and these are the different books within the Theravada tradition. Yeah? Four main books that you can see there. So you have the monk's rules, the nun's rules, and then you have a chapter on legal topics, and then you have like a summary kind of treatise in the bottom there. Yeah, all right, so there you are. So I wouldn't recommend reading the Vinaya, to be honest with you, unless you are really, really interested. I would recommend reading the suttas, so forget about my translation work, because for most people, it is not interesting. I just have to be perfectly honest about that. It is really, for monastics, it's very interesting. For some lay people who are leaning that way, maybe interesting, right? But it's not for everyone. It's pretty boring, except for the odd story, like the zombie story. It's pretty boring, yeah. Yes, I think all, yeah, pretty much, yeah, everywhere, yeah, most monasteries.
And the computers are being used for teaching the sutta, or not?
Yeah, teaching and communicating and, you know, whatever really computers are used for elsewhere, they're used for the same thing in the monastery, you know, administration work, whatever is required. Not used enormous amounts, but you know, and every monastery has like a secretary usually, and they, you know, and these kind of things, yeah. So, yeah, but in your kuti, normally don't have a computer, so usually this would be like in an office or something like that, yeah. So, yeah.
Just to get that, He's just always on the forum.
Is it, say again?
Sujata.
Yeah.
Does he have a computer in his kuti or
no? Well, he doesn't. He doesn't live in the kuti at the moment. He lives in an apartment in Sydney, in the city. Yeah, that's where he lives.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so he has a small apartment. He certainly has his own computer, and he does a lot of work. Yeah. But he meditates as well. It's not just computer work, right? He has a reasonably balanced life. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He answers a lot of questions, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's very prolific kind of person. He has a very high work capacity. It's amazing what he's able to do. It leaves most people in the dust when it comes to work capacity. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. So, yeah. Anything else? Yeah, Adam.
I was wondering, when you're talking earlier about the transmission of the suggestion, are there, so like in a non-monastic tradition, that they have been reciting the same books, or, is there any evidence of sort of reciting separate things in their tradition?
Yeah. It is actually very hard to know. It is quite possible that they did, but there's very little evidence of it anywhere left over. But you would think, the nuns were supposed to recite their own patimokkhas, on the Upasatha days, because the nun sangha, the bhikkhunis and the bhikkhus are completely separate. So the nuns do all of their patimokkha recitation on their own. They do all the what is called sangha kamma. Sangha means the action of the sangha. It's all the legal procedures of the sangha. They do that separately. So there are really two separate entities, the monks and the nuns. There is a little bit of overlap, but basically they are separated, yeah. So they probably would have remembered some things, but mostly it would have been the monks. The Indian culture is a very patriarchal culture. Basically the monks were the ones who would have recited these things, generally speaking, yeah. Yeah. Mm. Okay, yeah. Did I answer your question properly before about the suttas? Were you okay with that? You sure? Yeah? Okay. Because I could go in. There's a lot of detail there, right? Which is interesting. Yeah. So I don't know you well enough to know exactly where you're at. Okay, great. Okay, so we have a few more minutes. I will carry on a little bit more with this particular sutta, getting rid of resentment. So we have looked at the first way of getting rid of resentment. We come to the second way here. How should you get rid of resentment for a person whose behavior by speech is impure, but whose behavior by body is pure? So this is the reverse of the previous one. And again, I don't think it matters all that much, speech, body, just the idea that some aspect is more pure than others. But maybe the idea is also sometimes it can change. Yeah, sometimes people may be pure in one area, then they change, so you have to be a bit flexible in how you perceive them. Suppose there was a lotus pond covered with moss and aquatic plants. Then along comes a person struggling in the oppressive heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. They'd plunge into the lotus pond, sweep apart the moss and aquatic plants, drink from the cupped hands, and be on their way. In the same way, at that time, you should ignore that person's impure behavior by way of speech, and focus on their pure behavior by way of body. That is how to get rid of resentment for that person. So basically the same idea. The difference is here the simile. So you come to a lotus pond, and the lotus pond is here the simile for the person. Person is like a lotus pond, but it is covered with moss and aquatic plants. And of course, moss and aquatic plants, or moss and algae, these are like the defilements in the person, or the bad qualities, yeah? You see that on the surface, this is the bad stuff. And so when you come and you see those bad qualities, you just push them aside, yeah? But before we come to that point, the person who comes is struggling in the oppressive heat. And of course, the idea of heat is a metaphor in the suttas for anger, right? You are heated. It can also be a metaphor for desire, but certainly for anger in the suttas. And you are weary, and of course, anger, after a while, it may energize you initially, but after a while, it makes you tired. If you get angry, after you've been angry for a while, you kind of, I just want to go to sleep or something. And so you're weary, thirsty, This means that the person is looking for a way out, perhaps. You're thirsty, looking for some way of finding a way out of that anger. So, and because you are thirsty, looking for a way out, you plunge into the lotus pond. You sweep apart the moss and the algae. You sweep it away. These are bad things. Don't want anything to do with them. Get rid of them. And then you drink from the pure water underneath with the cupped hands. Yeah, you imbibe, you take on board the good qualities in your mind, just like you take on board the water to your body, you take on board the good qualities in your mind in this way. Yeah, and then of course, then you carry it with you, because you carry that water with you afterwards. In the same way, you take those good qualities with you afterwards. So you drink up the good qualities of other people. It's a nice way of thinking about it. Drink them in, take them on board. Okay, let's go on to the next person now. How should you get rid of resentment for a person whose behavior by body and speech is impure, but who gets an openness and clarity of the heart from time to time? So before I go on to the actual similes and things, we need to be clear about openness and clarity of the heart. What does this mean? The Pali is here, Cheto Vivarana, I think, and Cheto Pasada. And Vivarana is the opposite of Nivarana. Nivarana are the five hindrances, Vivarana are the opposite, so they are a lack of the five hindrances. Yeah, your heart is open because you don't have these blockages in there that block you and hinder you from making progress. This is the Vivarana of the heart. And pasada is a word which is very similar to the idea of confidence, clarity of the heart. Yeah, clarity, confidence. So the idea here is that even though you are a bit of a dodgy character, yeah, bad speech, bad body, whatever, you still have that purity of the mind occasionally. Yeah? That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because normally we think that when someone is a bad character by body and speech, we normally think of them as having a bad mind as well, because these things usually go together. But not always. And this is kind of the point, because human beings, we are very complicated. Yeah, sometimes you find human beings who are outwardly very bad, but actually they do still have good qualities within them. So we should not jump to conclusions too quickly. This is part of what this is about. When we judge people, we should be careful. We should kind of take things into account. And sometimes you will notice that actually there are people who are, even though they are outwardly bad, that actually they do have some beautiful qualities within them. Yeah, they are able to attain some good meditation states or whatever. It seems really unfair, right? The dodgy characters getting good meditation, whereas, oh, I'm trying so hard, I'm being so nice and kind, don't get anywhere. Wow, this is really unbearable. But this is life for you. Life is unfair sometimes. So, but it's important to take this on board so we don't jump to conclusions. We're not too hard on people. And we try to see goodness wherever it is found. This is the idea here with the vivarana of the heart, openness and clarity of the heart from time to time. Of course, if they keep on acting badly by way of body and speech, eventually their mind will get clouded as well, because eventually it will affect your mind. But for a time, maybe because of past life practice or whatever, they can keep that up for a while at least. Suppose there was a little water in a cow's hoof print. Then along comes a person struggling in the oppressive heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. They might think, this little bit of water is in the cow's hoof print. If I drink it with my cupped hands or a bowl, I'll stir it up and disturb it, making it undrinkable. Why don't I get down on all fours and drink it up like a cow? Then be on my way. So that is what they do. In the same way, at that time, you should ignore that person's impure behavior by way of body and speech, and focus on the fact that they get an openness and clarity of the heart from time to time. That is how to get rid of resentment for that person. So here there is only a tiny little bit of good qualities, yeah, not very much at all, and so you have to be very careful That is why this idea of the cow's hoof print, there's only a small amount of water, small amount of good quality, isn't it? And if you are not careful, if you look a little bit too far to the left, not to the right, and a little bit far to the left, you see the bad qualities. You have to focus down very narrowly. Get down on all fours like a cow. Suck the water up with your mouth. Don't touch it with your hands. Just suck it up. And then you can get some clean water. Otherwise, you will disturb it. It will become muddy. And you see all the negative qualities in that person. This is kind of the idea here. So you focus very narrowly. You see those things that are good in that person. And you rejoice in that. You think, wow, what a wonderful thing it is that they actually have those good qualities there. So this points to the idea that actually seeing the good in other people is very important. Yeah, being able to draw out, even when it's very hard to do, even when you have to focus very narrowly in this way, we should always look for the good qualities. This is very important. Why is it so important? This is kind of interesting, what is going on here. And I think the answer is that when we look for the good qualities in other people, it always has a good result. Seeing the good qualities in others really is like metta. It's like being friendly with someone. If someone is your friend, you see their good qualities, right? That's what friendliness very often means. So this is a focus on metta. We take the metta, the loving kindness, the friendliness, the goodwill towards others, we take that as far as possible. If there's any scope at all for having metta, because there are some good qualities, we should utilize that scope to create a good feeling on that basis. So it is, what it is saying really is that metta is very important. Yeah? In Buddhism, we have the four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abidings. The first one is metta, often translated as loving kindness, or you can translate it as goodwill if you like, or friendliness, many possible translations. Second one is karuna, which is compassion. Third one is mudita, which is like often given as sympathetic joy. It really just means joy, but it is explained in the commentaries as sympathetic joy. That has become the standard translation. And the last one is upeka, which is equanimity or evenness of mind. Right? So now there's four of them. And the sequence is always the same. And as I've said, in Buddhism, sequences are not random. There's a reason why there is a sequence. So the fact that metta is first, karuna is second, the fact that the sequence is like that is actually important. It matters. And what it means, of course, is that metta is the most important and the most basic of these Brahma Viharas. We should practice that first. That should be our first focus. That is why it is always first. And lo and behold, if you start reading the suttas, what is it, which Brahma Vihara do you find most frequently explained in the suttas? Well, actually, it is metta. Metta is talked about quite frequently. If you want to read a little bit about metta, you can look at suttas like Majjhima Nikaya 21, the Kakkachupama Sutta, the simile of the saw, 21st Sutta of the middle-length sayings. It has a lot of nice ideas. That is where you find the famous simile of the saw. You know the simile of the saw? Don't know the simile of the saw? Huh? Yes, you know. Okay, a few of you do. Okay, so a few of you who are educated in the suttas. The simile of the saw is great. We'll come back to that later on, maybe. Okay. Remind me if I forget, but I want to come back to this one later on. So that is found, that's it. The suttas about metta is found in places like the Kosambya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 48, which talks about metta in a broader context, which is very interesting. You have the Karaniya Metta Sutta, of course, in the Sutta Nipata, which is one of the most beloved of all the suttas of the Pali Canon. You have in the Anguttara Nikaya, you have the Metta Nisangsa Sutta, the suttas on the benefit of metta practice. So you find metta kind of spread around in the suttas quite often. It is clearly the most important of the four Brahma Viharas. The second most important one is karuna, which also is talked about quite a bit, karuna being compassion. But metta is first. So why is that? And the reason, again, is that metta, you can never go wrong with it. If you see the good qualities in other people, it will never have a bad effect. Yeah, you will just rejoice in the goodness in others. You will feel good. You will be able to help the other person in feeling good as well. Yeah, and basically, it has a very positive effect when we have metta. Karuna, compassion, is a little bit more tricky. Because compassion basically means the desire to alleviate the suffering in other people. And when we are dealing with suffering, it is very easy for the mind can very easily see that suffering and feel maybe some sadness, maybe, yeah, and can become depressed as well. You can even lose your energy if you look too much on the suffering in the world. So it is a bit more tricky to get it right. Yeah, and that is why compassion is a more advanced kind of practice. It is important, we'll come to it later on, but it's a bit more advanced. With metta, you can never go wrong. With compassion, it's a bit more easy to go wrong. So, one way of thinking about this is to think about the difference between empathy and compassion. And this is an important distinction in the English language that is not always appreciated. But there is an important distinction between the two. Now, empathy means to feel with someone, right? So if someone else is feeling really bad, you kind of feel bad as well, because you feel with that person. And empathy is good, but only up to a point. If there's too much empathy, if you kind of feel with all the suffering in the world, you're going to have a terrible life, because you're going to feel all the suffering all the time. So empathy should not be overdone. And one of the things that you sometimes find in Buddhist circles is that people overdo the idea of empathy, feeling with people all the time, and they become completely debilitated. And this is true. There are people who say in Buddhism they become debilitated because they feel so much with people who suffer in the world that they become paralyzed, they lose all their energy, they just become depressed and sad. Please don't do that. Yeah, that is a really bad idea. It is the opposite idea in Buddhism. We want to be energized. We want to be joyful. We want to have clarity. We don't want to become debilitated. So that is taking it too far. And this is where compassion comes in. Compassion is different in that it actually wishes for the liberation of that person from suffering. So it is more active. It is more, what can I do to help them? Yeah. And that thought of wanting to be of help to others and helping them emerge from suffering, that is actually a positive feeling. Yeah, you're no longer feeling what they are feeling. You obviously have some idea that they are suffering, but you don't feel directly with them. Instead of doing that, you have compassion. You want to help them. Is there anything I can do? I wish they were happy. I really want you to be happy. And that wish is a positive feeling. So make that distinction in your life, understanding that there is a difference between empathy and compassion. One can be problematic, whereas the other one is always a beautiful feeling once you get it right. And then you're going to be on the right track. So this is what this one here is about, the idea that of taking metta as far as possible. There's also another beautiful thing that I mentioned before about this idea of looking at the good qualities in other people. It is actually what we do when we see the good in other people. We're giving them a gift. Yeah, I mentioned this last night, but I think it may be worthwhile mentioning it again. Because when you see the good in other people, that tends to grow in that person. You are reminding the other person that they have good qualities, right? If we always see the good, the bad in other people, that is what they tend to be reminded of, because they can kind of feel it. Yeah, it's not, you don't have to say it, they can feel it whether you're seeing the good in them or not. And then they tend to live up to that badness if you see the bad in them. So we're giving other people a gift by seeing the goodness in them. And we're then giving them the opportunity to emerge from the bad qualities and develop themselves in a good way. It's an act of compassion to have metta for others already. So don't forget that. Don't imprison other people in their bad qualities. Because when we judge people harshly, we're actually imprisoning that person. And sometimes they feel it's hopeless, I can't get out of this anyway. Other people are judging me in a bad way. And then they kind of become worse as a consequence. So give people the gift of metta and kindness in this way, of seeing their good qualities. It's a wonderful thing to do. So that is it for now. It's already 4:00. So I wish you a good remainder of the afternoon. I'm going to go over and do some interviews. So if you are on those interviews, I'll see you over there in a few minutes. Otherwise, we'll see you back again at 7:00 this evening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.